Architecture has often been compared to language. Here's a pretty blatant example. 18th century book of a guy who thought he could come up with an architectural alphabet. I'm not going to talk about this. You can, though, go to the library and find some famous books. There's a book by John Summerson that we all read called The Classical Language of Architecture. There's another one by a modern Italian architect named Bruno Zevi called The Modern Language of Architecture. Great 19th century book is called The Grammar of Ornament. Or there's Vignola's Rules for the Orders of Architecture, which is itself a kind of grammar book. Here are a couple of samples. On the left is Vignola's book called The Rules, The Five Orders of Architecture, which, not using the word, is a kind of linguistic guide to how to make architecture. And with Zevi's book, we have a plate that shows his own kind of grammar, his lexicon for how to make architecture in a modern style, we could say. The language analogy has persisted throughout the history of architecture and architectural theory. Interestingly, architecture has, throughout its history, borrowed liberally from philosophy, linguistics, and literary criticism, and not the least, as in the 20th century, the linguistic studies of semiotics, structuralism, post-structuralism, deconstruction have had a direct bearing on what architects do. Some of these recent developments have been such that there are questions in the academy as to whether there is any language anywhere at any time, and whether there is meaning in the universe, ultimately. And there are many architects who would demur on this and suggest that perhaps there's not. And of course, there have been architects who, throughout history, have said, architecture is not a language, it's just building, it's just construction. We'll look at that premise. But it seems to me that anyone who has walked outside in the built environment and has looked at buildings with their own eyes understands that it is possible to read the built environment, to read architecture in general. For example, we can look at this view. It's a painted view of an ideal city from the 15th century. And we can read something about the nature of this place. I mean, we could sit here and talk about what kind of a place is. What are these buildings saying to us? I'm not going to read it right now, but we can do that in our own environments too, right? We can drive down the street. We don't do this, right? We're fixed on getting through the traffic, but we could read our built environment. Sometimes it's easy, right? There are signs. You can read those signs, and that's what we're looking for. But this is an environment that is made of things, built things, including buildings, though the buildings might be secondary in this case. And so what we want to look at is how are we, how might we read these environments? We can look at architecture, right? There's urban environments. Take these two church buildings. Each is communicating something to a larger world. Each is using an architectural language to speak a message. In this case, the message is about the institution of the church. The language of the church building is, we ought to remember, a significant part of the witness of the church, which Dr. Old had mentioned. I agree with him fully that this is probably the most important way to look at church architecture, as witness. We'll say as communication, as language today. The best and earliest instance of the language analogy is quite old. I found it in the book of Genesis in chapter 11, a familiar passage, which I call, I actually teach this in my classes, I call this the foundational text of architectural theory. Might not be how you've thought of it. Now the whole earth had one language and one and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, we're told, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top to the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. A familiar passage to all of you, I'm sure. Now, here's the theory, right? The story of Babel, which we remember is not just a tower, but a city, is significant in many ways for architecture. There are three reasons, three motivations for why the Babel builders built that were given in the text, at least three that I can find. First, they were out to make a name for themselves. That's the one that we're interested in. Secondly, they didn't want to be scattered. They were afraid of being scattered and placeless, I would say. And perhaps most importantly, they wanted to reach the heavens. They wanted to reach God in their own terms. Now, I could go on for a long time about all three of these. I'm not. I just want to say a few things about the first one. Making a name for yourself. Primarily, of course, this suggests pride. And pride and arrogance have, I'm afraid to say, played a very large role in the history of architecture and continue to do so. But more subtly, what I find here is that this is a kind of linguistic act, right? Making a name, right? Literally, naming something. Names and naming, we know in the Hebrew world, was a very important thing. Bible names of persons and places are descriptive of the character and circumstances of origin, the essence of the thing named. Indeed, the very word Babel, the historians tell us, and the linguists tell us, in the ancient language, as it would in a modern Semitic language, literally means the gate of God, the idea of reaching up to the heavens. And we know what happened to that name as when God destroyed them. It became Babel as we understand it, or not understand. The builders wanted to construct access to God. So they wanted to do this through a linguistic act, making a name. But rather than a linguistic act, rather than writing a paper, giving a speech, they built buildings. This was a form of language, a form of proposition. Architecture is a form of saying. It has been and continues to be. That's what I would read from this text. So how does the language of architecture work? How do we read buildings? How can we interpret the built environment? Several methods, I would say, to reading and writing architecture that I'd like to outline. The first is actually the non-answer. This is, or the denial of the answer. The first is what I'll call functionalism. The functionalist is a person who says that architecture doesn't mean, it just is, and it is a thing made to solve problems. It's a function. We will, I'm going to go back to that, but we will also consider the hermeneutic models or methods of style, semiotics or iconography, typology, and finally ornament. And then I'm going to try to wrap this up by looking at how these things come together in a tool for reading and writing. So the functionalist model is it's often associated with the 20th century. Functionalists are those who say, you've heard these phrases, form follows function. Louis Sullivan's famous dictum in the early 20th century. Or Le Corbusier, who said, a house is a machine for living. Very famous phrase. And here, of course, is one of Le Corbusier's famous houses, looking a bit like a machine. I don't want to get into that very much. He didn't really believe exactly what he said. But there it is. He said it. Anyway, and this premise could, if we're looking at churches, suggest that we could say if a house is a machine for living, we make the most efficient machine possible, that we could say, as church architects, that a church is a machine for worshiping, and follow the formula, have a functionalist approach to architecture. Now, the functionalist approach has its high-style practitioners. Mies van der Rohe's IIT Chapel, quite famous, one could read as a functionalist approach to church architecture, although we could interpret it other way. You could also say that the expedience of using what is available or of not thinking of the church building as primarily important, whatever motivations are behind a storefront church or a church meeting in some other obscure location, is a functionalist approach. I'm not sure if this church is actually open. I just found this on the web and thought it would make a good illustration. But you know what I'm talking about. And I'm not going to say that this sort of thing would be wrong to do. It may be the best thing to do, maybe not exactly like this, but the best and the only thing to do in a given circumstance. So functionalism certainly has its place. Or we might be a pragmatically minded builder of churches or other such buildings, thinking that function is the primary driver of what it is that we build or design. I think there's a little bit more to it in this case, but I could tell you, if you cited someone rather prominent in the media recently, Rick Warren, for example, says, "We see our buildings as tools for ministry, not monuments." Clearly, a functionalist approach is a decided theory of architecture for Pastor Warren and for others like him, perhaps. Here's his church, actually, at Saddleback. And this is a church which is very functional. I've not been there, but it serves the purposes that they have. It serves their approach to worship, and it looks very functional as well. We don't focus on the architecture per se, and I think that is the point. So functionalism is the non-answer, but it's one that we'll have to deal with, and I'm not going to dismiss it. We'll come back to it. Another way to read buildings is one that I'm sure you're familiar with. It's highly problematic, though, and that's the issue of style. Many people can talk or have heard about style in architecture. In the 18th and 19th centuries, historians began accounting for differences in architectural design by categorizing buildings according to style. Style was an invention. The idea that there is such a thing as style was a 19th century invention, really. It's a messy concept, but in general, it suggests that the physical features and forms associated with architecture of certain epochs and are associated with the architecture of certain epochs in history. So there's a Greek style, there's a Roman, Romanesque, neoclassical, Egyptian, Chinese, and ad infinitum. There are many styles of buildings. And, of course, there are various reasons as to why an architect would choose, we would say, to work in a given style. The 19th century was the century of styles, the battle of the styles. And I show here an array of churches in different styles, which we could name and discuss had we the time. One historical style, however, was considered by some to have been particularly Christian. In the early 19th century, a Catholic theologian architect, a very important fellow named Augustus Welby Northmore Hugin, very 19th century name, reaffirmed his Catholic roots and believed that we needed to return with the advent of industrialization and capitalism and all those nasty things, we needed to return to a true and better time, a time like the Middle Ages, when we actually built Christian buildings. He wrote a book, in fact, called The True Principles of Pointed Style, or Christian Architecture. If you want to know what Christian architecture is, read Hugin's book, and he'll tell you. This was a repudiation of the pagan forms that Protestants had been using, buildings like this one, and that were common in England. And, of course, what he started was a huge movement, a movement that will transform the landscape of England and of America. The staunchly evangelical Anglican John Ruskin, while not agreeing with Hugin's Catholicism, also saw Gothic architecture as the most truthful, beautiful, and expressive architecture, and thus the best suited for a Christian approach to architecture. Inspired in part, then, by Hugin, the 19th century saw the rise of the ecclesiological movement in the Anglican Church, a movement that brought a tidal wave of Gothic church building. We'll see two examples of that on our tour today. Here's another plate from another of Hugin's books. He's weighing the scales and sees that Gothic is, of course, much more weighty and true than classical architecture. Read Catholic versus Protestant simultaneously. So there's an approach to style. Now, style doesn't stop in the 19th century. Many architects in the 19th century were fed up with the style wars, saying, what's this all about, whether we should do Egyptian, Gothic, or Romanesque? What we need, here's the battle cry of the late 19th century, the 20th century, what we need is a style for our time, a style for ourselves, a style for our age. And, well, that's theoretically, there's some problems with that, but they had some help. They went back and they read the early 19th century idealist philosopher Hegel. Hegel had developed an idea that I mentioned last time called the Zeitgeist. It's a German word that literally means the spirit of the age. And the architects said in the early 20th century, well, that's it. What style should we build in? The style of the spirit of our age. That's the style. How would you know what that style is? Well, that's not clear. It seems that they would engage in a kind of divination of sorts, trying to get in touch with the Geist in order to find out what their Zeit was, and therefore come up with buildings that reflected that Zeitgeist. And here's what they came up with. A variety of buildings, which we are told in all seriousness, as they present these to committees and in fancy books written for academics, how these buildings are expressive of our age and how that is their primary responsibility. That's what they're meant to do, is to be expressive of their age. That's style as well. It's the same style as imitating the Egyptians or the Romanesque, right? I think I'll be like an ancient Egyptian today. I think I'll be like whatever the Zeitgeist has got for us today. This was a way to make buildings, and this would then be, for art historians, a way to read buildings. You figure out what the Geist is, and you read back, and you then interpret the building according to that. So style, contemporary style, right? Think about that for a minute. What on earth could that mean? That's what they were grappling with. Don't think that this was just in the high-style architectural offices where these discussions, or the schools of architecture. The idea that there is a Geist, that there is a spirit, that there is a style, a contemporary style, or a plurality of styles, as we get to the late 20th century, we move from Zeitgeist theory to a postmodern, commodified, tailor-made approach to style. Your own style, make your own style, etc. And this, of course, affects not only the architecture, but liturgy, worship styles. Here's a sign at Saddleback Church, and in case you didn't read it, right, this is it. You can choose. What is your style? You choose. You determine what your style is. So the style approach is one that is common not only to architecture, but to much of postmodern life. Okay, there's style. That's one way to read a building. Let's look at another one. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to throw out some fancy words here. I was going to call this, and maybe I will, the semiotic approach. There we are, borrowing from linguistics. The science of semiotics is a word that was coined in the early 20th century by linguists. It's the theory of that language is a system of signs, that we can understand human language, spoken language, as a collection, as a systematic as a system of signs. And it wasn't long before others in anthropology and other discourses began to say, well, it's not just language, not just words, but things which are signs and can be read and interpreted. The whole world is a collection of signs. Art historians do something of the same thing when we study what we call iconography, from icon, Greek word for sign, and writing, graphy. That art and art history is studied through sign writing. So this is the sign, or you could say symbolism approach to reading buildings. And of course, it's not a new one. It's not a 20th century invention. It was quite common in the Middle Ages with theologians. The world is a text, one could say, was the hermeneutic, the approach to all the world that theologians had in the Middle Ages. Here's the model, right? If God, if we're looking at the built world, if God created the heavens and the heavens declare the glory of God, then the things that are made by men also are a form of declaration, and we can interpret what is being declared as God's book of nature is a declaration from which we can interpret general revelation, we could call it. Well, what does that mean in architecture? It means that architecture, like church building especially, is nothing but a collection of signs to be read, symbols. Literally, in the case of Vézelay at the great pilgrimage church, where we see Christ and the apostles being sent out. This was the Crusader pilgrimage church, where crusaders left from after prayers and services to go out and reclaim the Holy Land. So the analogy of Christ sending out the apostles was quite prominent. That's what's displayed in the gate, in the doorway, the portal at Vézelay. This is in a greater context. Let me read you a rather lengthy passage from a rather early theologian, Rabanus Maurus, who lived in the Ottonian period of the late 8th century AD, who wrote a book about nature, in which he describes the Temple of Solomon. We keep coming back to that. The bases, he says, describing the columns in front of the temple, the bases can be mystically understood as the books of divine testament on which rest the doctrine of the holy preachers, for the columns are the apostles and the teachers of the gospel. These persons were prefigured in the two columns in which we read that Hiram put up the building, the temple of the Lord, as it is written in the book of Kings. Hiram completed the whole work of the king in the house of God, that is, the two columns, the epistyles, the beams, and the capitals, something like netting covering the capitals above the epistyles. These are the columns about which Paul says James, Cephas, and John, who seem to be columns, gave Barnabas and me the right hand of friendship so that we would go along among the Gentiles and among the Jews, by which word he seems to expound the mystery of the material columns, both what they apparently represented and why there were two. For they stand for the apostles and all the spiritual doctors raised up toward the heavens and strong in faith and works and meditation. And they are two because by their preaching they introduced the Gentiles and the circumcised into the church. For the columns stood in the portico of the doors of the temple and provided a wonderful decoration for its entrance by their ornaments and beauty. For the door of the temple is the Lord, because no one comes to the Father except through him. And he says elsewhere, I am the door, and anyone who enters through me will be saved, because the columns clearly stand at either side of the door, and by the help of the text they show entry into the kingdom of heaven to both peoples. Is he discussing buildings, or are the buildings analogies to help us understand spiritual truths? In repeated cases in the Middle Ages, we find that that the line is not clear, and it's very clear in general, but never specifically, that we are meant to read churches built in the Middle Ages as text, so that when, as I tell my students, when you go to a medieval church, take your hands out of your pockets and get ready to start counting, if you need to use your fingers. Get ready to start counting things that you see, right? Look at the doors and the bays as they appear. Are there three of something signifying the Trinity? Are there four signifying the evangelists, or 12 signifying the apostles, and many more combinations? If you see that, it's likely that that was symbolically intended, and therefore that's what it means. Unfortunately, this is what keeps historians in business. We're never actually sure if that was meant, but we know in general that that this was done. Provides a lot of work for historians. Well, a few things we know. Take, for example, the glorious vaulted ceiling at Amiens Cathedral. The distance from the floor to the apex, you couldn't know this by using your fingers, is 144 Roman feet. You'd have to read that. 144 Roman feet, that doesn't come out in English feet, nor in meters, on the analogy that this was John's dimension for the cubical heavenly Jerusalem. That is, the dimensions were symbolic. In this manner, transcendent ideas are encoded into the physical structure of the cathedral, says art historian Stephen Murray from Columbia. Or take the baptistry at Florence, and I don't need to elaborate on this because Dr. Old had explained it, right? Baptistries frequently, not always, but frequently, whether it's just the font or the building, have eight sides, as many texts will tell us, representing actually a layer of ideas, but preeminently that the eighth day is the day of resurrection and entry into the new covenant will be properly symbolized by this idea. Or something that might be a little less apparent would be esoteric symbolism such as light. Light was very important to the Abbot Suger, who we've heard about a couple times, right? Christ is the light of the world. Christ is God. God is invisible. Light is invisible. But Christ became visible by becoming man. Light becomes visible when it becomes colored. Therefore, we have the incarnation represented in the use of colored light in a church. So rich symbolism can be found, and we could spend days and days interpreting using an iconographic or semiotic approach to buildings. We find this in the Counter-Reformation as well as a kind of rhetoric. For example, the fact that a transept intersects perpendicularly with a basilica forms a cruciform plan. That had been noticed, but in the post-Trent era, it was said that you better then build your church as a cruciform because it is in the shape of a man crucified of Christ himself and has symbolic meaning. Well, all right. There's some medieval semiotics. Now, I said that semiotics was popular in the modern period as well. In fact, by the 1960s and 70s, architects were reading Charles Sanders Peirce and Fernand de Saussure and many others on language, and they were beginning to think, reacting to the modern functionalists, that architecture really was a kind of language, and we needed to interpret architecture as a system of signs. Several expounded on this subject, none more famous than Robert Venturi, great Philadelphia architect, and his wife, Denise Scott Brown, has revolutionized architecture in many ways. They took this literally, and he wasn't that deep theoretically. They took it literally and said, well, if signs are the most important thing about architecture, then let's study architecture as sign, and let's go to the center of the world of signage. Let's go to Las Vegas and study how signs, literally, signs that you drive by in your car, speak to architecture. And one of the conclusions he came with is that the buildings are really relatively unimportant compared to the signs. This was rather distressing for the modern architects who were trying to create sacred spaces and other such things, but it really caught fire. And Venturi pointed out that this is not only true in the present age, but it has always, or it has been true. You can't really see it well, but in this map, he shows Las Vegas signs compared with billboards, Roman triumphal arches, and Gothic cathedrals, all of which operated as signs, meant to be seen, as he says, at certain traveling speeds that determines the size of your sign, and one of the reasons why signs get tall and big and neon is because we're driving in our cars and not walking through the streets. There were more sophisticated approaches to this as well, people like Peter Eisenman, for example, or Bruno Zevi, who said that we should study architecture as a code, as a structural code, which is on the analogy with the structure, or even to use Chomsky's word, the deep structure that language has. Let's discover how this works in architecture, and then let's build an architecture that is based on these principles. Well, there's yet another approach, too, in this semiotic world. The idea that that space making, right, that architecture is the enclosure of space, is a very compelling idea for 20th century architects such as Rudolf Schwarz, who constructed something we could call a poetics of space, to cite another architect. This actually is directly related to what we heard Dr. Roll talk about with Mircea Eliade, who himself is looking at a language of space and a language of time which speak to the idea of spirituality. That is there a way of demarcating sacred space or any kind of space? Is there a way to construct spaces of various sorts? Is there a code that can be discovered? And certain architects have studied this. Rudolf Schwarz wrote a book called On Church Architecture in 1938, a Catholic modernist, a mystic, a philosopher, who came up with an elaborate idea about pathways, spaces, and rituals as generators of sacred space, and he built churches according to his own principles. Here's one of them. It doesn't look like much. It looks rather functionalist. This is a church in Aachen, in Germany. This box here, it's based on this idea of the series of six, and he creates these perfectly proportioned spiritual spaces. So a semiotics of sacred space, we could call it. And we return again to Tadao Ando, the Japanese architect we saw last night, and here again at a different chapel, the Chapel of Water, not light in this case, in which the idea of constructing a language of the spiritual is part of his project. Well, okay, let's move to another approach. There's our semiotic approach. Let's move to architecture as typology. I'm borrowing again. This is confusing, I know, when I've spoken with theologians. Architects use this word all the time, typology. But I guess you do in seminary, too. In architecture, it's really pretty simple. Buildings come in certain types, and it's really simple, right? If I say gas station, you know what I'm talking about, and you could draw one. You know what gas stations look like. Here's one, in case you don't know, right? They follow a pattern, a type, a typology. How about something more basic? The house, the proverbial child's drawing of a house. Ask a five-year-old or whatever age to draw a house, and they almost, even cross-culturally, always draw the same thing. A gable, front door, chimney with smoke. Yeah, it's got it there. Window, and maybe the family. And there it is. There's the house. There's something to that. That is, the house does follow a typology. Here it's a little more sophisticated. An archaeologist drawing houses in the ancient Near East. And guess what? They follow the pattern of the child's drawing of the house. They're longitudinal boxes. They have a door on the short side. And this, of course, is the basis of the Greek temple, right? The house is recognizable. We all know what it is. In the 20th century, architects pretended as though nobody knew what houses looked like. And every time they got a client who came up and said, I want you to design a house, they pulled out their hair and said, gosh, what is this house going to be? All they had to do was think back to the child's drawing. Houses are houses. We know what they look like. Let's start with that. Some would say this is actually Venturi's approach as well. Well, all right, here is a 19th century shotgun house. Here, next to it on the left, is a Katrina cottage, a recently designed by a New York architect house. It's been very successful. You can buy it at Lowe's, ready to go. And you might recognize Athena's house, surrounded by columns, not just the front porch, but the all-around porch, like a Louisiana house. I should give extra credit for anyone who can identify this building. I will take that. Anyone shout that out? You should all be embarrassed, right? This is the Virginia State House. It's the capital of Virginia. It was designed by a pretty famous guy named Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, is using the temple idea, which is a house, to create. Right? It's a house. You see the linguistic move here. It's a house of government, not the house of the god. And there's something meaningful in doing that. Now, let's think about how that works in a broader manner. Suppose I take a house with a wraparound porch like the Parthenon. Suppose I unfold the sides like this, and I create the temple in the middle, the house, with the unfolded arms, and I put two pavilions on each side. I've got a palace, which also happens to look like a castle, and I've got a pretty impressive palace. I also, this is one of the ones where I berate students. We talked about the Louvre. Half the Americans, at least, who go to the Louvre never recognize this picture. This is the front door of the Louvre. This is the most important part. It's not the glass pyramid. It's not any of the rooms around the side. This is the front door. It's one of the most important houses in history of architecture. Very influential. But it's based on the house typology. It's architecture based on a typological approach and a typological reading. We can add something to that. Let's add to our lexicon. We have the house, and remember from last night, you also have the circular house. Occasionally, think of a teepee, for example, we have houses that come in circles, or temples that come in circles, like the Greek sanctuary at Delphi, or the Pantheon, or now let's take the Pantheon. Do you see what the Pantheon is? It's the rectangular house pasted together with the circular house. Let's take that idea, move it to Charlottesville, Virginia, and call it the library of a school with all the meanings loaded into it. Here is a typologically generated architecture. Or, in a different direction, let's take the circular house, let's put it in the center of a church, and let's add the house with the unfolded arms in the front, in front of a basilica, and let's generate St. Peter's Basilica. Do you see how this language works, right? Buildings can be made, many buildings, like most buildings in the history of architecture, can be made by thinking of these types being rearranged in various ways. And the meaning that is associated with them comes with. It's no extra cost. You get the intended meanings of circular buildings and the cosmos and the heavens and all those things. to add to the meaning of the building. So we can read buildings typologically. Just another example. Take the house with the front porch. It's not quite a shotgun house, but it's the same idea. And stick a tower through the middle of it. And there we get a type that we talked about last night, a highly recognizable type, so recognizable that this type is not only this is the house, this is the church, this is the steeple idea, it becomes embedded in the American psyche. In Thanksgiving edition of Life magazine in 1944, as the war is raging but winding down, Americans were consoled to see this building, which everyone thought was the typical New England colonial church, right? Which happened to be built in Ohio in the 19th century. But that's our model, right? That's what we think of, and it's a powerful one. So there is a typology to churches. If you get that, we know what churches are. I ask you to draw a house or a gas station, you know what it is. I ask you to make a church, and you know what it is. It follows a typology. But, as we said, not everyone is going to operate in this way. The functionalists would go to a non-typological approach, or another modernist approach would be, as Peter Eisenman said, to reinvent or disturb the typology, to resist the typology, so that we might not be roped in to a historical approach to architecture. And you could say that that was true with some contemporary church buildings. Another example of perhaps a non-typological church. But these churches are not non-typological, are they? For example, you know what these are. They are familiar. Here's some pictures of an office park. I have to tell you what it is. You're not surprised, but it could be many things, right? It's an office park, various views. I just got this from a real estate website. Some office park in Jacksonville, Florida, not far from here. Maybe you know it, but you wouldn't remember it because it's not memorable. Maybe this is more memorable, right? Here are buildings with signage that follow a predictable pattern, right? This now is a typology. We call it the big box architecture. And this, of course, is the typology that's being adopted for building churches these days. In fact, it's a very comfortable typology, isn't it? Especially, I was looking for big box and thinking, should I show Sam's Club or Costco, or should I show Trader Joe's and Target? Should I go upscale a few notches to match what is closer to what you find in contemporary church building? And I think I found, I don't know, something closer to the match. So buildings operate typologically, but not all architects, not all builders would acknowledge this or think of it as significant. I know this is blurry. This is from a great book called Architecture, Choice, or Fate, written by the Belgian atheist classicist Leon Krier, who is very witty. He shows us here on your right buildings that follow typologies, including cooling towers from nuclear power stations, as well as more recognizable things. And he contrasts that with the architecture of the contemporary landscape, which refuses to follow typologies, so we're confused. We don't know whether a building is a nuclear reactor or a church or whatever. He calls this uniform, that is, it's all the same, versus form. Okay, so that's one approach, typology. Let me add now, try to go quickly, another interpretive device. This is a little more classical. How about reading architecture as a form of rhetoric? Architecture as a form of speech making, as a form of communication that has its own system or art. I could also call this architecture as ornament. That architecture is a language that's based on typology is not separate from this idea. Architecture is written, architecture is clarified by the use of ornament, and this is part of a rhetorical language. We see this in books like The Grammar of Ornament in the 19th century, or in Perrault, a 17th century designer of the Louvre, by the way, in his book about the five orders of architecture. If you were studying architecture from the 17th century until World War II, you would have to memorize, learn how to draw, and properly proportion the five orders of architecture. For some, this was like learning the Ten Commandments, or some some divine truth. It wasn't intended to be quite that. It was more like learning your grammar, studying your Warner's grammar book. You learn what are the rules for writing architecture, and the orders, the columns, such as we have in this room, were central to this this language, the Corinthian order, with all of its complicated parts. This is something you have to study. You can't just ask somebody to go out and say, make me a building that has columns on it. You have to learn how to write. You have to go to school and learn this grammar. Okay. Now, there's the grammar. Let me now introduce you, I'll see how quickly we can do this, to a system of ornament. My favorite writers, I mentioned him last night, is the Renaissance humanist Leon Battista Alberti. A priest, works for the Pope, humanist, brilliant man, and an architect who wrote a book in the middle of the 15th century called On Building, On Architecture. And in this book, he gives us a theory of ornament. First thing he says, it's most important that an architect design buildings which are beautiful, and he'll tell us how to do that by using proportion and harmony, really important stuff, but I'm not going to go into it. He then says, once you know how to design beautiful buildings, you should make them even more beautiful by learning how to do ornament. An ornament works like this. Ornament is related to typology. Typology can be thought of in a civic way. Right. Buildings fall into two categories. All architects know this. Their businesses are divided this way. There's public and there's private, houses and everything else. So architecture is either public or private. Alberti says, architecture is either public or private. It's also either sacred or profane. Now, I'm not going to go into what he meant by sacred, but let's just say we know, right? There were churches were sacred, and bicycle sheds are profane. There's not a hard line, there's a continuum. And in fact, all buildings are either sacred or profane and private or public, which creates a kind of grid. So you could have public sacred buildings, or you could have public profane buildings. You end up with four categories, more or less. So Alberti says, these are the categories. Let's think how they relate to each other when you're building something like a city. And the answer is, ornament should be the system of writing that gives clarity to these relationships. Now, I can actually illustrate that. Alberti even designed buildings. And this is just great. He probably thought of this. He had one client, a really rich guy in Florence named Giovanni Rucellai, who needed a house. So Alberti designed this house for him. It doesn't look like much to us. He just did the facade. What's remarkable about this is it's the first in history to have things that look like columns, pilasters, they're not really columns, that ornament this this building. They're superposed one on top of the next. This building is private. It's also profane. So that's its system of ornament, which you can illustrate more carefully here, right? It was modeled on, perhaps, on the Colosseum, the idea of stacking orders. Very innovative, even though it may not look much to you. It was revolutionary in its own day. It was ornamental. It was a grand palace for a really rich guy, a guy who was private, but because he was famous, he was more public than your average private citizen. Now, Giovanni Rucellai was wealthy enough to do what most Southerners want, built a porch on his house, except that in Florence, you didn't always build it on your house, you built it across the street from your house. So here is his loggia in a plan. There's the palace, the loggia, that's the Italian word for porch, and this is what it looks like. Three big arches and fully round columns. Without going into specifics, this system of ornament, using columns rather than pilasters, better materials and larger scale, clearly shouts out, I am also a private building, but even though I'm smaller, I'm a public-private building. The clarity of ornament, of rhetoric. Now, Giovanni Rucellai was a church-going man, and his parish church happened to be the Dominican monastery of Santa Maria Novella, which was unfinished at the time, and he had Alberti finish the facade of this glorious church. What you're looking at is Alberti's work, paid for by Rucellai, and this building is public, and it is sacred. It's made of marble, of color, with fabulous details. It clearly is distinct, higher, more important, with a public space in front of it than Giovanni Rucellai's house. Here are some of the details. Now, Giovanni Rucellai was a man, and so he died, and he knew he was going to die, so he built a tomb for himself before his death, which was modeled on the Holy Sepulchre, no doubt, and which is a building that is also designed by Alberti, and it is private, but it is sacred. And it's small, but it's very fine. There's a clarity of language in these buildings. Here's a picture of Giovanni Rucellai with all his buildings there. It was as if he and Alberti got together and said, let's show the world how we can create a system of rhetoric, of ornament for architecture. Some believe that this view that I showed you earlier is an Albertian city. It's a city made of buildings, ornamented, decorated, and using typologies that are clear, rational, and reveal truths about that society through their use of ornaments. We could say the same about buildings that we've looked at. Here is a building that has a system of ornament that is clear, responds to public and private concerns, and speaks to the public in a very clear way, I believe. As we saw last night, the same could be said for the Center Church on New Haven Green. Or let's go down the scale, right? There's Venice, and then there's New Haven, and then there's Blauenberg, New Jersey. It's a great little town with a beautiful little church. This is not a very good picture of it. It's actually exquisite. But of course, it's not as grand. It's appropriate to its context. So this brings me then finally to a conclusion you'll be happy to know. What should we do, right, given all this? These are my approaches to reading. We've got functionalism. We've got typology. We have style. We have semiotics, or a series of signs. And then we have rhetoric, models from which we can interpret buildings. What should we use in writing buildings? Well, let me say that the church, I would agree with Dr. Roll here, is primarily a witness. It is something that reveals what is behind the idea, the ecclesia of the church. Function is very important. The church needs to be functional, but function can't be a generator. It never actually is. It's not a generator. Louis Sullivan, form does not follow function purely and simply without any intermediary. But function is very important. What I think is more important, or as important, is something that is behind what Alberti was talking about, and that's the Latin rhetorical concept of decorum. You all know what decorum is. Your mother has taught you what decorum is, right? How to sit at the table, how to dress, how to behave at parties, how to behave at church, which is a different thing. The context for one is different, and so your behavior will be different for the other. It's like public and private in architecture. There are rules of decorum. This word was actually used by ancient writers like Vitruvius and Alberti to describe how we are to design buildings. So decorum, doing the right thing, to use Spike Lee's version of decorum, is, I think, the ultimate for the architect. Let me put this in further perspective. The church, as we said last night, the real church is the ecclesia. Now, this works in architecture too, right? A house is an architectural form, but the house is not the most important thing. The house is the form that is made to embody, to house, to function, and represent the institution. The institution would be the home. A house represents a home. That's what architecture does. Architecture, one of my professors said, is always subservient to institutions. I'm sorry for the architects, right? You are less important than society and the institutions of society. Buildings serve society, and society is made up of institutions. And God has ordained certain institutions. The family would be one, right? The family is more important than any building, and the family makes the home, and the architect makes the house, which serves the family. It doesn't only serve, it represents. This is a kind of linguistic act, right? It says something about the family. Okay? Well, the church, the ecclesia, is an institution. Church buildings serve the institution. They serve the functional requirements. Functionalism is important. But they also represent, they speak a language about, they bear witness. We could go on and on with the analogies of that institution. That's a secondary role, like John the Baptist that we heard of. They point to the truths that are higher than themselves. This, I think, is the architecture that that we strive for. This is the architecture. I'll leave you with this slide. This is the matrix I think we want, or the question we want to be asking as we read the built environment. How does this building represent, how does it serve, and how does it represent the institution of the church? Does it do it with dignity and decorum? Is it appropriate? Is it uplifting? Is it ennobling? We ask the same questions we ask of ourselves and our behavior. That's where I want to leave you right now. I'm going to pick up on this theme. This leads directly to the theme of urbanism, which will be our Saturday theme. It's also related to what we'll look at tonight when we look at worship. But I'm going to leave you with that thought, and we'll think about these things as we take our tour as well, and I will end, and I will take a few questions for a few minutes. Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of speculation here, and there's not a total agreement. I'm fully convinced. I studied gates for my dissertation, not churches. I'm fully convinced that the twin-towered church is and always has been a representation back to its Syrian origins of a gate, of a city gate. And city gates back to ancient Babylon have been twin towers. You need two towers with archers on either side to shoot the people going in the door. The twin-towered gate is a type that we all know. So that type is very old. As far as single towers, that's quite old as well. We have, especially in Italy, single bell towers, campanile, which are attended to early Christian churches, and their purpose is to hoist a very heavy, loud bell that can be heard from a great distance, and also have a place for a watchman to look out and see who's coming in times of anxiety. So it was a common form to have a single tower parallel to the history of twin-towered churches. I don't think there was actually a move away from the twin towers necessarily. It was just there are two parallel approaches. The tower holds the bell. That raises the question, should we continue making churches that have bell towers today? And I won't get into that right now. Mm-hmm. He did. I'll show that tomorrow, actually. Yeah. Yeah. And the New England town. I grew up in Connecticut, and my aunt and uncle lived next to the Connecticut River. And on a clear day, which wasn't very often, you could go up hiking into a high spot, and you could look out, and you could see the leaves on a fall day. Spectacular. And you would see nothing else but the river and the leaves in the hills and occasionally a white steeple poking up from all of that, bearing witness, as Dr. Old had said, in a really wonderful way. So that obviously is a function of a tower besides holding a bell, a marker. So.